All right. Thank you. So I'm filling in for Dr. Tanavala, and I'll be her topic that she's been tasked with is antibody structure and function. Most of you who've had lab experience probably know about antibodies, using them in various assays. I'll go over that at the end, the use of antibodies in common assays that we have here. But I want to give just a general flavor and talk about how antibodies look like, the structure, and how they're used for immunotherapy of cancer, and also how they're used for in general for any sort of medical application. Here's my contact information. Easiest to get hold of me is by email if you have any questions. So I believe one of your earlier lectures is about the cells of the immune system. So probably talked about how there's a hematopoietic stem cell that eventually results in most of the immune cells. The one I'll be talking about is antibodies which are derived or produced by B cells that come from a common lymphoid progenitor. This is just a little bit of background about how B cells fit into the general architecture of the immune cells. Really isn't as critical to know other than B cells are the source for antibodies or immunoglobulins. And these antibodies are actually expressed on the surface of B cells, and they have the ability to recognize various antigens or any sort of molecule, whether it's surface bound or soluble. It can also include DNA, RNA molecules, any chemical or chemical structure, or any molecular structure. So they have an infinite possibility of what we call epitopes or pattern recognition sequences that antibodies can recognize and react to. I'll be talking a little bit about what the antibody looks like. The antibody itself can be generally broken down into two areas, two components: the ability to recognize various antigens, any epitopes that is found in the variable region or the antigen binding site, the ability to then exert an effect after it's recognized antigen. That aspect is encoded by the constant region of the antibody. And so antibodies are actually made up of four polypeptide chains, two light chains, and one heavy chain. And these polypeptide chains are actually bound together by a disulfide bond that connects the light chain to the heavy chain, and then another set of disulfide bonds that binds the two heavy chains. As you can see here, within each of these chains, whether the heavy chain or the light chain, they both encode a variable region and a constant region. And within those regions, the constant or the variable region, they have these canonical immunoglobulin binding sites that result in these common features of the loop structure found in the light chain and in the heavy chain, both in the variable region and in the heavy chain. As you can see here, the light chain actually consists of one constant region, and the heavy chain actually consists of multiple constant regions, depending on the type of antibody that is, whether it's IgA or IgM. I'll go into that in the next slide. But within each of these regions, there's what's known as an immunoglobulin domain, a very canonical structure that is repeated throughout the structure of the antibody. And within these regions, it's what creates what's known as a beta barrel. These are two anti-parallel strands that form a barrel structure. And these beta strands are found both in the variable region and in the constant region. And they are, as you see right here, they are actually bound together by a disulfide bond. This immunoglobulin domain is actually quite common throughout protein structures. It's not just in the immunoglobulin, the antibody structure, that's where it was first discovered or first characterized, but it's actually found in multiple immune structures, including the T cell receptor. I believe you have a lecture on that coming up, and also on other types of cytokine and adhesion molecules. So it's a very common structure that's present in these protein families. It's in fact a superfamily that has this common beta barrel structure. The antibody itself is a large molecule that has a couple of unique features to it. It has this hinge region, and it has multiple carbohydrates that are interspersed throughout the structure. It's the combination of the variable region in the light chain and the heavy chain that actually encodes its ability to recognize various antigens. So what is it about that variable region that allows the antibody to recognize multiple structures? So it has multiple variable regions that are actually have the highest amount of variability. It has framework regions here in blue, but they're interspersed between these hypervariable regions. And each of the variable regions in the heavy chain or in the light chain have three regions of multiple types of antibody, or I'm sorry, amino acid sequences. And within this hypervariable region within the light chain, what you see are these beta barrels that form the framework, and the loops that stick out correspond to the hypervariable region. And in a three-dimensional schematic, these hypervariable regions actually protrude out and form the basis of recognition of various structures. And that is what forms the antigen binding site. And this is present in both the light chain and in the heavy chain. Together, they work in concert to generate this complementarity determining region that allows these this immune structure to recognize various antigens. So the key one that is mostly looked at for determining what is all the ability to have infinite possibility or near infinite possibility of antigen recognition is the CDR3 region, the complementarity determining region. And this is the combination of this hypervariable region from the heavy chain and the light chain. And what we have here is, how does the antibody itself recognize an antigen? It's at the interface of the antigen binding site, the CDR3s of the heavy and light chain, that recognize a unique epitope of an antigen. So this one is a representation of an influenza antigen and the binding of a antibody that has specificity for this antigen. And you can see that most of the recognition occurs at this point of the antigen, of the antibody molecule. One of the unique aspects of antibodies, go ahead. CDR3s have the most variability. That's where most of the variability in achieving antigen recognition occurs. So it's spread out over the 1, 2, and 3, but the greatest variation is in CDR3. So one of the unique aspects here of antigen or antibodies is that they are able to recognize linear epitopes that are spread throughout multiple areas within a molecule. So whereas the sequence of this antigen, the influenza antigen, has a three-dimensional structure, the actual recognition of the antibody occurs over multiple areas of that molecule. T-cell epitopes, as you'll learn in your next lecture, they have a linear epitope where they recognize peptides that are sequential. Whereas antigen, recognized by antibodies, they can recognize any structural variation, so it does not have to be sequential. That's one unique aspect of antibody recognition. So the immunoglobulin superfamily, again, comes up where you see that the B cell antibody, the actual region of the heavy chain and the light chain, actually resembles very similarly to the T cell receptor, though they have very unique aspects of recognizing antigen. Your next lecture will go into how the T cell receptor actually recognizes antigen. As I mentioned, the fine specificity of antibodies, they have this unique ability to recognize fine variation between chemical structures or any unique structure. So if you take a mouse and immunize it with this chemical meta-azobenzene sulfonate, which has this structure of the sulfate molecule, the mouse or the host will be able to elicit a response that is specific for this configuration. So those antibodies that are generated in this host may be able to recognize these unique structures, configurations of this molecule, but the greatest, or the fine specificity is once again with this, the original half-chain. So the immunoglobulin genes, there are spread out across various chromosomes in humans, and the heavy chain are all located on chromosome 14. The light chain actually consists of two types of light chains, a lambda light chain or a kappa light chain. So each antibody molecule consists of one type of heavy chain and one type of light chain. It's always either a kappa or a lambda. There is no intermixing of a kappa and a lambda. And it's always the same heavy chain and one heavy chain and one light chain of either kappa or lambda. So the type of antibody is determined by the constant region. And they fall into one of these five classes, IgG, encoded by the mu, the gamma gene, IgM, encoded by the mu gene, IgE, encoded by the epsilon gene, IgA, by the alpha, IgD, by the delta. Within IgG, there are actually subclasses as well that have their own unique properties. Same with IgA. And as I mentioned, the light chains can either be kappa or lambda. In humans and in mice, there is a skewing towards kappa, a preferential usage of kappa over lambda. And it's much greater skewing in mice, whereas in cattle, the skewing is reversed and it's mostly lambda. That's just as an FYI. So as I mentioned, each of the immunoglobulin family members have a unique structure and they exert their own unique effector function. The molecules that have this hinge region, which allow the flexibility, are found in IgG, IgD, and in IgA. The molecules IgE and IgM have actually four constant region domains, whereas IgG, IgD, and IgA have three constant region domains. And another unique aspect is the incorporation of the J chain in the IgA or the IgM, which allows them to form as either a dimer or a tentamer. And the forming of this pentameric structure or this dimeric structure is due to the binding of this J chain molecule. And another unique aspect of IgA is the fact that it incorporates this secretory component. So IgA is unique in that it's actually found in mucosal tissue. And the way that occurs is that a poly-Ig receptor binds the secretory component and allows for its transportation across into mucosal areas. So IgA that's found in mucosal tissue and mucus, saliva, tears, it's due to this transport across the epithelial barrier. So the molecules that have this hinge region, the reason that's a unique aspect of antibodies is that it allows them to have this flexibility to recognize multiple epitopes, repeating epitopes, without the constraint of the angle between the heavy chain and the light chain components. In fact, they can bind at multiple configurations, either as here, like with a 60-degree angle between the hinge region, or even 90-degree. So that allows flexibility to recognize multiple repeating epitopes. So in this schematic here, this is in humans. The size of the molecule itself depends on the subclass of the heavy chain. And you can see that IgG3 actually is slightly larger compared to its subclass IgG1, 2, and 4. And each one of these molecules has its own unique characteristics based on the subclass or isotype. The antibody can have the same antigen binding site, the variable region, but its variation in the constant region is what allows it to exert any of its effector function or its ability to result in any downstream effect. So the expression of the gamma 1 heavy chain may affect its concentration in the serum level compared to if the molecule now did what's known as isotype switching into an IgM molecule. And each of the subclasses has its own biological function. So you can see here that complement activation is primarily restricted in humans to antibodies that have the IgG1, IgG3, or IgM. The other isotypes are really poor at activating complement. Whereas the one molecule here that's really unique here is IgE, which has this ability to activate mast cells and basophils. So that's a really unique molecule. If you've heard of asthmatic and allergic reactions, those are primarily achieved by IgE molecules. So as you can see here, that the various functions of the antibodies are determined by the isotype, the constant region, whether it's an IgG, IgA, M, D, or E. The way that this was discovered was actually based on proteolytic cleavage of these antibodies. So a unique aspect is PAC-A, which cleaves right at the hinge region of IgG molecules and results in the generation of two components which are known as FAB, fragment antigen binding, because it has both the heavy chain and the light chain components, antigen binding sites, and what's known as the FC, or the crystallizable fragment. Whereas pepsin, cleavage by pepsin results in a molecule that has intact or bound together FAB regions, and the constant region is broken down further into smaller components. One of the unique aspects as well is the ability to isolate these two variable regions of the heavy and light chain, and that's what's known as a single chain variable region. So that SCFB, you may have heard of that, and that's becoming more common usage for a lot of therapeutic applications, whether it's antibody targeting or cell therapy. The two variable regions of the heavy chain and the light chain are cloned to generate this single chain. This is just a repeat of then 2ME actually further breaks it down into each single component of one heavy chain, of two heavy chains, and the two light chains. So as I started off in the beginning, that B cells express the immunoglobulin, the antibody, on its surface, this can also be secreted. And the way that is achieved is by loop transcriptional regulation of removing this plasma membrane, the transmembrane domain that allows the antibody to be expressed through the plasma membrane. When that region is removed by transcriptional regulation, that this molecule is now secreted. And this is where it's present in plasma, serum, mucosal surfaces as well. And this is all achieved by that one B cell. So, go ahead.
Is there any evidence for proteolytic cleavage of the plasma membrane?
Proteolytic cleavage within the cell?
Yeah, of the plasma membrane domain.
So, in the actual B cell, once it becomes activated to secrete the antibody, the molecule actually undergoes this, the transcript itself actually starts to remove that sequence, and now the secretion signal is now transcribed rather than the plasma membrane component. So now it no longer has this ability to create these anchor residues within the plasma membrane, and that therefore it's secreted. So there's no actual proteolytic cleavage, it's just transcriptional regulation. And this one, yeah, we have the membrane and secreted forms of IgM. The plasma membrane bound IgM has this component within the molecule that is actually removed during transcriptional regulation, and it goes back to its ability to secrete expression of the secretion signal. So how do the B cells actually become activated? When B cells recognize an antigen, it starts a signal, cascade where it receives help from T cells to then proliferate. The B cells that have recognized an antigen and received help go on to become memory cells and also plasma cells. So plasma cells are a unique type of B cell. Their entire function is to generate antibody, secretion of the immunoglobulin into the tissue or into the blood. So B cells, as I mentioned in my first slide, that they are derived from this lymphoid progenitor. And they are formed, they undergo some tolerance mechanisms, selection to remove out B cells that have an autoreactive phenotype. So within the bone marrow, those cells that react strongly to self-antigens undergo apoptosis and are removed from the repertoire, and only those B cells that have an ability to recognize non-self-reactive molecules survive and make it out to the periphery. When those mature B cells now encounter antigen, they once again become undergo this differentiation either into memory cells so that they can persist for re-encounter with that same antigen, or they become plasma cells where their entire goal is to generate lots of this antibody for secretion. So this, signaling in B cells is, as I mentioned once again, it's through the antigen binding domain. And this molecule, the immunoglobulin molecule, is in concert with these two co-receptors, the alpha and beta chain, that allow it to signal and result in B cell activation. So when there's cross-linking of multiple B cell receptors, so it's not just the one B cell receptor. If this molecule were to span within that molecule itself, it would not result in a downstream effect. It has to occur across multiple B cell receptors. And there's a downstream effect of phosphorylation through these second messenger molecules that result in B cell activation. The other aspect from T cells is their ability to generate different types of cytokines. And that is what results also in the switching from various types of the isotypes, whether it's IgM or IgG1, 2. And this is regulated by the different types of cytokines that T cells can produce. There are some cytokines that promote a unique type of isotype, and there's others that actually inhibit generation of IgG molecules. And this is actively determined by the T cell health. So getting past the actual structure of the molecule, antibodies, the next part is how do they actually exert their function once they've been once they've secreted. In host defense, whether it's bacteria, they have two unique roles. One is just their ability to neutralize any secreted toxin and prevent that toxin from causing any damage. This molecule that now, this complex of the antibody and the antigen itself is removed from the circulation by any phagocytic cell, such as a macrophage. Bacteria can also be removed by antibody by coating the bacteria with the antibody itself. These antibodies can recognize any unique structure on the surface of the bacteria and prevent that bacteria from colonizing. And because the bacteria is coated with antibodies, it can once again be recognized by macrophages and ingest that entire complex of bacteria coated with antibody. Another unique aspect of bacteria that are coated with antibody is activation of complement. So on bacteria that are coated with antibody, this results in activation of this complement cascade that eventually results in the lysis of the bacteria, therefore killing it rather than having to ingest by the macrophage. I've already talked about how neutralization works by preventing toxins binding to cellular receptors. And here's a schematic of an antibody preventing the toxin from binding its cognate receptor. So in multiple types of bacteria infections, whether it's Clostridium or cholera, there are molecules in various vaccines, such as like Tdap, where the goal is to elicit an antibody response that can prevent these bacteria from colonizing or even prevent their toxins from creating any tissue damage. So this is just a list of various conditions for which antibody response is useful to prevent any adverse events. Talk about the role of opsonization, which is antibody molecules that coat a bacteria and then result in its ingestion by a phagocyte. And this is once again a little bit further going into how complement activation occurs or results in destruction of the bacteria that is coated with an antibody. So one of the unique aspects on this schematic is the role of Fc receptors. Fc receptors are expressed on phagocytic cells and in fact any other type of immune cell. These Fc receptors recognize the constant region of an antibody molecule. So there are Fc receptors that are specific for IgG, there's Fc receptors specific for each of the isotypes, gamma, alpha, mu, epsilon, delta, and that is what allows any phagocytic cell to recognize the antibody. The antigen binding domain binds to the antigen, and the Fc receptor binds to that constant region, and that is the link between resulting in the activation of its effector function. So antibodies can also prevent bacteria from colonizing or creating any biofilms by recognizing any unique structure on the surface of the bacteria and preventing them from binding to adhesion molecules. So it's not just bacteria, it can also neutralize virus. In one example of a viral life cycle, the virus will recognize a cell surface receptor, become internalized, and start its viral life cycle. And in vaccinations such as flu vaccine, the goal is to elicit antibody that will prevent the bacteria from binding to one of these receptors and allowing the virus to infect the like a lung epithelial cell And so these antibodies will bind to the virus and neutralize it and prevent it from enacting its life cycle within the epithelial cell. And one an additional function of antibodies is the activation, and this is common for cancer cells, is the activation of what's known as antibody-dependent cell-mediated cytotoxicity, or ADCC. So in this process, a cell that has a unique antigen on its surface is coated by soluble antibodies. And these antibodies now, their Fc region is now recognized by a unique immune cell known as the natural killer cell, which expresses Fc receptors. This activates the NK cell to now kill the target cell that has been coated with these antibodies and resulting in the apoptosis of that target cell. So this is a really unique mechanism employed in cancer recognition and cancer immunoediting by the immune system. And this incorporates the use of antibodies and a cytotoxic immune cell. And finally, you've probably heard about monoclonal antibodies. You've used them a lot in a lot of various assays. And this is achieved by the fact that plasma cells secrete copious amounts of antibodies. And that's how we're able to generate various clones of cells that just secrete antigen or antibody after antibody. Each clone actually secretes just a single type of immunoglobulin with one specificity. And I won't go into too much detail how this is achieved, but this is done by fusing the plasma cell, which has one type of antibody it produces, with a myeloma cell. And the fusion product of a cell that secretes antibody and has fused with a myeloma cell is placed under condition within HAP media, which forces the cell that has HGPRT, this enzyme for a salvage pathway, to survive, and any cell that has not fused will die, and any myeloma cell that has not fused with a plasma cell will die. And that results in a clone, a hybridoma, that is able to secrete antibody against any specific antigen. And so these monoclonal antibodies is just a unique aspect. In fact, Cesar Milstein received the Nobel Prize for discovering how to generate monoclonal antibodies. So these monoclonal antibodies, or any antibody in fact, can be used in multiple types of assays. And so the next part of this will be talking about how antibodies are used in common techniques, lab techniques. And one of this is ELISA, or enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay. It makes use of the fact that antibodies have a specificity for a single antigen, and that antibodies can also recognize other antibodies. And this is what's done in an indirect ELISA. In a sandwich ELISA, antibodies can be used to serve as a receptor for any antigen. So you can measure how much of any soluble molecule is present in any biological fluid or biological tissue. So this is another aspect of an ELISA. It was what's known as an ELI spot, E-L-I spot. And that makes use of the fact that cells can secrete molecules that are recognized and detected by plate-bound antibody. And the same molecule can now be detected and result in production of a color reagent that is detected on a membrane rather than on a translucent well. And so the use of this ELI spot is to calculate the frequency of cells that secrete any given molecule. And antibodies themselves can be used for IHC or immunofluorescence, whether it's on paraffin-bound tissue or frozen tissue. Another aspect is the use of immunoprecipitation. You can have a bead that is bound with antibody that can actually pull down your molecule of interest based on the specificity of the antibody. And that molecule of interest can then be eluted to have a greater concentration of any soluble antigen that you're interested in isolating. And everyone probably knows about Western blotting, of using SPS page electrophoresis to separate out various proteins of different sizes and different charge. This is then transferred onto a membrane and it's detected with antibodies that have been labeled with any sort of tracer, whether it's a radio label tracer or a enzyme tracer, and then you can detect and determine the concentration of the molecule within any soluble mixture. That's just another fancy usage of immunoprecipitation. We'll get into that. And then finally, there's flow cytometry, which once again uses the specificity of antibodies to recognize unique structures either on the cell surface or intracellularly. And those antibody molecules are conjugated to fluorescent molecules rather than like a radio label or a chemiluminescent label. And these are now run on a flow cytometer machine, and the lasers are able to excite and detect variations in the fluorescent molecule. And this is then used to determine the frequency and the expression levels of any molecule. So finally, because this is about oncology, how are monoclonal antibodies used for in oncology? I had mentioned already the first aspect, which is antibodies coat the surface of a target cell, and it results in activation of a pathway known as ADCC via NK cells. The other aspect that monoclonal antibodies can be used is delivery of a toxin or a radioactive substance to the target tumor cell itself. So these antibodies are conjugated to a toxin or radioactive isotope, resulting in the cell death. So most of those antibodies that are used in immunotherapy have been originally were from mouse origin, but that results in some issues with the half-life of putting in a mouse derived antibody into a human. One of the ways they've gotten around that is by using this system called the xenomouse, in which the mouse's endogenous immunoglobulin genes, whether the light chain or the heavy chain, they've been removed, and in its place are all the human IgG or IV heavy chain or the light chain. So the resulting antibody generated in these mice from immunization is of human origin, and therefore it's likely to expect a longer half-life within patients. And the first antibody that actually was developed from this system is panitumumab, which was used for EGF blockade. So actually, antibodies, because they are encoded by heavy chain and light chain, these can also be re-engineered for additional purposes. There are molecules that are actually chimeric, where they have a human constant region but have the mouse variable region. Because most of the response to a mouse antibody is directed against the Fc region, one way to circumvent that is by creating a chimeric molecule that retains the mouse components for antigen binding and is replaced with the human constant region. Therefore, it does not impact the ability of this molecule to recognize antigen. Another way is to humanize only the CDR3s within this molecule, so that the majority of the structure is human, but the regions that exert the recognition are derived from the mouse, so that the majority of this molecule still can exist in circulation without being neutralized. One other aspect that's becoming more common nowadays is this heteroconjugate. In the beginning, I mentioned how an antibody actually consists of one type of heavy chain and one type of light chain. A heteroconjugate actually consists of two types of heavy chain and two types of light chains. And this is used so that the entire molecule has two various regions for binding antigens, so they no longer have a common antigen binding site at the FAV. It now has two types of antigen binding recognition areas, so that you can bring together two different antigens in close proximity. One way that's done is to, on one side of the molecule, is to have the ability to activate an immune cell, and on the other side is to have the ability to recognize a surface antigen on a tumor cell. So you're able to bring together the T cell in close proximity to the tumor cell and hope that that activation by this side of it, the anti-T cell side, results in the activation of the T cell and killing of the tumor cell. In fact, monoclonal antibodies, there's a whole list of monoclonal antibodies that are now being used in various conditions, including cancer. These are two of the ones that have gained a lot of traction here, bevacizumab and cetuximab. These are not just for now colorectal, they've advanced many other types of cancers. They've become a standard for many types, ovarian cancer, pancreatic, but these are no longer restricted to just any inflammatory disease or vaccinations. They're now actively being used in treatments of cancers. Um, this is the last part of the talk. How are the antibodies themselves useful for anti-tumor effect? The first on the right here is ADCC. I talked about that, how the surface molecule on the tumor cell is recognized by an antigen, by the antibody, and results in activation of a NK cell. Another unique aspect that's not very common is activation of complement. Just as it was done on bacteria, elicit complement activation on tumor cells. This is much less common than it is for bacteria. But there have been reports that this does occur on blood-borne cancers. And finally, the antibodies themselves can be used to deprive the tumor cell of growth factors or any of its ability to evade the immune recognition. Therefore, it will binding or recognition of the antibody on the surface of the tumor cell results in apoptosis or even lysis. And the first molecule, monoclonal, that was approved for cancer is Rituxan, which is directed against CD20 present on lymphoma cells. And as I'd mentioned, antibodies can be used to prevent growth factor signaling. So tumor cells and even endothelial cells primarily express VEGF. And when they bind VEGF, the growth factor, it results in activation and angiogenesis, or providing all the necessary molecules and nutrients for the growing tumor. Treatment with bevacizumab, that now removes circulating VEGF and prevents signaling on the VEGF receptor. And therefore, this tumor cell is starved of a neoangiogenesis and results in cell death. And you've probably heard about Herceptin, which is an anti-HER2 antibody. And HER2 encodes a protein, tyrosine kinase, that's overexpressed in breast cancers. And Herceptin is a monoclonal that recognizes HER2. And it prevents EGF from binding and exerting a growth factor effect on those tumor cells that express HER2. Okay, I think that's pretty much it, a rush through antibody. If there's any questions about this or the review article?